Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, the last Sunday in March 29th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona. The second hour begins by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Margaret Marilyn Armbruster, Esther Roca Avalos, Eileen Anita Hoffman DeRose, Richard Lawson, Virginia Lee Naramore, Richard John Passe, known as Dick, Keitha Eileen Reed, Buzz Stevens, who was known as Willard, Walter Robert Ullman, and June Harris Wilson. Sunsounds of Arizona extends his condolences to the families and friends of the people listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the economy section of the paper. Looks like there's just one article in the economy section. It's entitled, "Despite Possible Changes, Don't Wait to File Your State Taxes, Experts Say." This was an article written by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. for the Arizona Republic. With 3 weeks left before Arizona's April 15th tax deadline, experts have a clear message: don't wait to file. Some taxpayers are unsure if they should file now. Arizona lawmakers may still change state tax rules to match federal updates, causing some residents to wonder if they should hold off. According to the tax experts, they should not. There is no reason for Arizonans to wait to file their state or federal 2025 tax return. That's a quote from Mark Stebber, chief tax officer at Jackson Hewitt. Mark went on and said, quote, "Taxpayers should file their tax return instead of waiting on state updates," unquote. Now, filing now has immediate benefits. It helps protect your personal information from identity theft and fraud. And if you're owed a refund, you will get it sooner. And if you owe taxes, you will know how much to pay by April 15th. But at the same time, there is still uncertainty. A political standoff between state leaders means that tax rules could change later. And if that happens, some filers may need to amend their 2025 state returns. However, state officials say the current tax forms are still valid and can be used now. Stebber said that it's not likely that the new laws will force people to change their state returns. And the Arizona Department of Revenue pushed back on that characterization. The state cannot make real-time adjustments to tax changes on a taxpayer's behalf, according to Rebecca Wilder, who is a department spokesperson. If the legislature does not pass a conformity bill at all, filers would not need to amend their 2025 returns, Wilder said. The circumstance that could require amended returns is if lawmakers pass a bill that does not include full conformity with federal tax law for 2025, which would result in a different tax liability than what was already reported. If a conformity bill is not passed this session, the legislature may address it in 2027, as it has done in prior years, Wilder said. Taxpayers with questions about their specific situation are encouraged to consult a tax professional. Carl Breedlove, principal tax research analyst at H&R Block, said the company has already updated its software based on guidance from the Arizona Department of Revenue last January. He said clients should follow the current rules and file now. The Arizona Department of Revenue has also outlined 5 steps that filers should keep in mind to avoid delays. Use correct tax credit codes. Keep filing status consistent throughout the return. Submit only 1 return per Social Security number. Double-check all the calculations. And complete the return in its entirety with accurate personal information. Now, one common mistake this season is not reporting major life changes from the past year, according to Breedlove. Breedlove said, quote, getting married, having a child, changing jobs, those can significantly affect your filing status, your credits, and your deductions. When they are overlooked, taxpayers often miss out on benefits and leave money on the table, unquote. Stebber said that some new deductions are available this year, including the ones for overtime pay and tip income and car loan interest and certain seniors. But these are not added automatically. You must claim them on your return. Stebber said, quote, if a taxpayer leaves off a credit or a deduction or an election on their tax return, it stays off. The IRS does not automatically correct tax returns that fail to claim tax benefits, unquote. So people who have not started their returns may still qualify for free help. The Arizona Free File Alliance offers free online filing for people who meet income limits. The ARP Foundation Tax Aid Program offers free help for people age 50 and older. The Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, or VITA, helps people who earn about $69,000 or less, as well as those with disabilities or limited English. Now, if you need more time, you can file for an extension by April 15th, because that will move the filing deadline to October 15th. However, you still must pay any taxes you owe by April 15th to avoid interest and penalties. And that was Ray Covarrubias Jr.'s article, Despite Possible Changes, Don't Wait to File Your State Taxes, Experts Say. Well, we're coming up on 7 minutes past the hour. Time to move on over to the sports section. The cover from the front page of the sports section is entitled Another Major Moment. It's written by Bob McManaman, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Championship Valley. Ooh, it has a nice ring to it, don't you think? Considering all the major national sporting events the greater Phoenix area has hosted and staged over the years, perhaps it should become Arizona's official new moniker. But I only wish I had thought of that first. The words, though, they belong to Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, who used them perfectly when summing up what it means to the city to host the 2026 NCAA Women's Final Four downtown on April 3rd and April 5th at the Mortgage Matchup Center. Gallego said recently at the arena during the Women's Final Four tip-off news conference, Championship Valley rises again. I'm so excited to welcome the Women's Final Four to downtown Phoenix. We're going to put on a great show. A national championship, incredible fun, fan-friendly activities for the whole family are coming to downtown Phoenix. We do an incredible job at major events, and I'm confident we will rise to the challenge. This will be the best Women's Final Four, unquote. Well, Championship Valley has been home to four separate Super Bowls, including two since 2015. And in that time, we have also hosted the NFL Pro Bowl in 2015, the College Football National Championship in 2016, the NCAA Men's Final Four twice, 2017 and 2024, the WNBA All-Star Game in 2024, and just last January, the College Football Playoff Semifinals in 2026. And guess what? Next February, the 2027 NBA All-Star Game is also coming to town. Beyond that, no major national sporting events are in the works, other than the usual annual events, you know, like the VRBO Fiesta Bowl at State Farm Stadium, and the Rate Bowl at Chase Field in college football, and the Waste Management Phoenix Open at the TPC Scottsdale in golf, and NASCAR at Phoenix Raceway, and NHRA drag racing at Firebird Motorsports Park. And, of course, there is Major League Baseball spring training in the Cactus League. Plus, we've got our share of local professional teams, like the NBA's Phoenix Suns, the MLB's Arizona Diamondbacks, the NFL's Arizona Cardinals, the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury, the USL Championship League's Phoenix Rising Football Club, the Indoor Football League's Arizona Rattlers, and, of course, then there's Arizona State Athletics. We've basically got it all, and sometimes it can be a rather competitive business when it comes to attracting attention and the almighty sports dollar. Although future Super Bowls and Final Fours and All-Star games are not expected anytime soon, it doesn't mean they won't come. Kyle Hedstrom, the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Arizona Sports and Events Alliance, Kyle said, quote, "We're looking out at the next 10 years, and we've got a nice, healthy pipeline of potential events. I have confidence that within the next 10 years, we're going to be, hopefully, as full up as we can be," unquote. Well, this is the first time the Women's Final Four is coming to the Valley, but it probably won't be the last if they do it right. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs said in a video statement that was played at the tip-off news conference, quote, "Time and time again, we have shown that nobody hosts the biggest sporting events better than Arizona, and the women's NCAA Final Four will be no different," unquote. Last year's Women's Final Four brought fans from all 50 states and 23 countries to Tampa, Florida. Total tournament attendance reached 351,000, the third largest all-time mark. It was the fourth straight year to top attendance of 315,000. And that 2025 championship game between UConn and South Carolina, that peaked at 9.9 million viewers. That was the third largest audience since ESPN began its exclusive rights agreement back in 1996. More than 300 ESPN personnel will descend on downtown Phoenix, supported by 9 production trucks on site, a similar level to what the network deploys for the college football playoff. The Women's Final Four will be broadcast in more than 200 countries worldwide, with ESPN producing more than 19 hours of combined studio and game coverage. Meg Aronowitz, ESPN's Senior Vice President of Production, said, quote, "This will be the biggest Women's Final Four we've ever produced in terms of technology and coverage," unquote. Now, women's basketball is proving its popularity with the sustained audience expansion, and it shouldn't be a surprise, according to Lynn Holtzman, who is the NCAA Vice President of Women's Basketball. Holtzman said, quote, "We continue to see this growth. It's not new. We've been growing for a long period of time. Of course, there's been this catapult forward over the last 5 years or so. And much of that can be attributed back to 2023 when we had the storylines around Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark." She went on and said, quote, "What that tells us when I mention those names is it's about our players and our coaches. That's the number one thing out of the gate. With that, then, we need to create these environments that fans of all ages are finding these connections to the players. What is it about their stories that compels me to want to be a part of this entire cultural phenomenon of women's sports, of which women's basketball is a preeminent leader within?" Unquote. Well, Holtzman says real flatly, the biggest reason is because, quote, "They are damn good basketball players," unquote. Players today are more skilled, more athletic, and are quicker and stronger. The strong connection between players at the college and WNBA level also cannot be overstated, Holtzman said, noting that, quote, "whether it's fashion or how they use social media," unquote, "the name, image, and likeness efforts have helped transform the women's game overall and meet the fans where they are at." According to the Arizona Sports and Events Alliance, the 2025 NCAA Women's Tournament as a whole drove 22.2 million engagements on social media accounts. Just attending a single college women's basketball game can help create new young fans, according to Arizona State coach Molly Miller. Miller said before she and her Sun Devils were eliminated by Virginia in the NCAA First Four, Miller said, quote, "What I've seen in arenas that I really love are the little boys and girls with Sharpies that are waiting for autographs in the tunnel. It's the little girls that have the same hairstyle as some of our players. I say that because I have a 9-year-old, Crosby, and her basketball team came to a game, and Marley, one of our players, had her hair up in a bubble braid. She had her hair in a ponytail with little sections of hair ties. We played on a Saturday, the whole team came, and then on Sunday I went to Crosby game, and their whole team had bubble braids. These kids are getting exposure to inspire this next generation," unquote. Well, the women's game is getting so popular, and the demand for viewership and attendance is so great. Holtzman notes that the women's Final Four will be held in a pair of domed facilities in 2028 and 2029 in order to accommodate the crowds. In 2028, they'll be in the Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis, and in 2029, the Alamo Dome in San Antonio. In 2027, the event is in Columbus, Ohio, at Nationwide Arena. It holds just about 20,000 fans. So let's enjoy the Women's Final Four while it's here, folks. Jay Perry, CEO of the Phoenix Final Four Local Organizing Committee, Jay said, quote, "We're looking forward to three unforgettable basketball games. And almost as important, we're also looking forward to the larger impact the championship will have on our state. The Women's Final Four will drive tourism and economic activity across Arizona. It will create philanthropic benefits for many programs that we're doing in the community, and it will shine a global spotlight on Arizona as a world-class destination, as a place to live, as a place to do business, and, of course, to host the major mega sporting events like the Arizona Women's Final Four." Unquote. So, will it return to Arizona one day? Well, probably. So too will other mega sporting events, including perhaps the NFL Draft and the Super Bowl. Don't forget, we are Championship Valley. And that was Bob McManaman's article, entitled Another Major Moment. Well, let's take a look at something else in here in the interior of the paper. Oh, yeah. D-backs first home series sees Tigers and ace lefty Skubal visit. This was written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic. So with their three games set in Los Angeles behind them, the Diamondbacks opened the home portion of their schedule on Monday, March 30th, when they host the Detroit Tigers for the first of three games at Chase Field. The series opener will mark the Diamondbacks' debut for right-hander Michael Soroka, who signed with the club in December. He will be opposed by right-hander Justin Verlander, the 43-year-old three-time Cy Young Award winner who is making his return to the Tigers, his original team. Soroka, who's 28, posted a 4.52 ERA last year. He'll be trying to show that he deserves to remain in the starting rotation. The Diamondbacks will have a decision to make within the next 2 weeks when right-hander Merrill Kelly returns from the injured list. Now, the Diamondbacks are 24-22 all-time against the Detroit Tigers, a team they have faced more than most others in the American League. For several years in the early years of interleague play, the Tigers were the Diamondbacks' natural rival in the AL. Tigers lefty Tarik Skubal, the two-time reigning AL Cy Young Award winner, is expected to pitch the series finale on Wednesday, April 11th. In his one career outing against the Diamondbacks, Skubal fired six innings of one-hit shutout ball in a start in 2024. Now, Skubal was originally drafted by the Diamondbacks, but did not sign. The Atlanta Braves will follow the Tigers into town for a four-game series that will begin on Thursday, April 2nd. The Diamondbacks went 4-2 against the Braves last year after dropping 5-7 to them back in 2024. And after facing Screwball in the previous series, they could miss lefty Chris Sale in the Braves series. And that was D-backs' first home series, sees Tigers and ace lefty Screwball visit. Our next article is by Dwayne Rankin, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. The Suns begin four-game road trip against the Grizzlies. The Phoenix Suns start a four-game road trip on Monday, March 30th, against the Memphis Grizzlies at FedEx Forum. The Suns are 17 wins and 18 losses in away games this season, losing their last four on the road. Phoenix is 1-1 against the Grizzlies this season, winning the second matchup 117-98 on January 7th in Memphis. Dylan Brooks scored 21 points against his former team. The Suns continue the road trip on March 31st versus the Orlando Magic at Kia Center. Phoenix won its first game against the Magic 113-110 in double overtime on February 21st. Jalen Green hit a game-winning corner three-pointer at the buzzer in the second overtime. The Suns will then face the Charlotte Hornets on April 2nd at Spectrum Center. They won their first matchup against the Hornets 111-99 back on March 8th. Suns All-Star Devin Booker posted a double-double of 30 points and 10 assists. And Phoenix concludes the four-game road trip on Sunday, April 5th, against the Chicago Bulls at United Center at 12:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. The Suns lost their home matchup against the Bulls 105-103 back on March 5th. This was Phoenix's only defeat during a seven-game stretch in which the Suns reached 12 games above 500. The Suns, which have clinched a play-in spot, are looking to return to the playoffs after missing postseason play last season with their 36-46 record. They reached 37 victories this season when defeating the Hornets in Phoenix. And that was Dwayne Rankin's article, Suns Begin Four-Game Road Trip Against the Grizzlies. Our next article is entitled Arizona State Set to Host NCAA Regional. This is all about college gymnastics, written by Jenna Ortiz, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Arizona State Gymnastics will have to face Arizona to keep its season going. The Sun Devils qualified for the NCAA Regionals for the eighth straight season and will have the home advantage at Desert Financial Arena, will be the host for the Tempe Regional. ASU's postseason will begin with a play-in meet against Arizona in the first round at 2 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on Wednesday, April 1st. Now, in the previous matchup, back on March 6th, the Wildcats edged the Sun Devils 196.4-196. Whew, that's a close one. Well, at the Big 12 Championship, ASU finished fourth overall, surpassing Arizona. They had ASU had 195.225, and Arizona had 194.725. It marked ASU's best finish at a conference championship since 2021, when the program also finished in fourth at the Pac-12 championship. The winner of this contest will advance to the second session of the second round against number 3 seed Florida, number 14 seed California, and Penn State. That will be on April 2nd at 7 p.m. The first session of the second round will include number 6th seed Georgia, number 11th seed Michigan State, BYU, and Southern Utah. That will be at 1 p.m. on April 2nd. The top two teams from each session of the second round we'll move on to the regional finals at Desert Financial Arena on April 4th. The top two teams, the top all-around competitors, and the top event specialist on each event from each regional will receive an automatic berth to the National Championships, which will be held April 17th through the 19th in Fort Worth, Texas. And that's the article, Arizona State Set to Host NCAA Regional. And our next sports article from the interior of the sports section is all about NASCAR. Frustration expected in chase of Reddick. When the NASCAR Cup Series rolls across the Virginia state line this week and checks into venerable Martinsville Speedway, competitors will not find anything different in Sunday's Cookout 400 that they have not encountered before. Because it's spring in Southern Virginia, and that means the start of the short track season, though it is rather shortened, too brief to be honest, in its current state. Back in the day, there truly was a stretch, 3/4 of a month, when NASCAR visited its moonshining roots in North Carolina and neighboring Tennessee and Virginia, usually in the year's fourth month, but sometimes in the previous one. But this time, it's March. And it's not three visits, it's just two. The 400-lapper at the half-mile Martinsville Speedway, NASCAR's oldest venue that opened back in 1947, is the first of just two back-to-back races on bull rings less than a mile in length. So let's just call this stop in Martinsville and the day race in Bristol a fortnight of fun and frustration, because short-track racing is usually straight-up fun, although the races will be 2 weeks apart and not on consecutive weekends due to Easter. It would be hard to ignore the growing frustration as one driver dominates the show. Okay, let's start with Chevrolet's struggles. Through six races, the manufacturer has recorded 11 top five finishes. Now that sounds like a lot, like nearly two per race, but it's been hard to get all the way up front. Ricky Stenhouse Jr., Shane Van Gisbergen, and Chase Elliott have each posted runner-up finishes at Daytona, COTA, and Vegas, respectively, but the bow-tied hot shoes have not been able to take their cars to victory lane. 1/6 of the way through the schedule, Chevy is experiencing its worst drought to start a season since the one before 2020, the COVID-stricken one that serves as a line of demarcation. In 2019, in an 0-for-9 skid, the manufacturer watched Toyota win 6 times and Ford notch 3 more before Elliott finally parked his number 9 Hendrick Motorsports ride in victory lane at Talladega on April 28th. Almost all the way to May, without winning. Chevy went winless over the next 6 to create a 1-for-16 stretch in nearly half the season. But at least Elliott bailed out General Motors. Hope springs for the racing group, though. Since 2020, no manufacturer has hauled its way out of tiny Martinsville Speedway with more grandfather clocks, the bullring's quirky trophy, than Chevy. In 12 races there, one of its drivers has left with the odd timepiece 6 times. William Byron with 3, while Elliott and Kyle Larson and Alex Bowman have 1 apiece. But the frustration runs through the garage, primarily due to the success of Toyota's Tyler Reddick, who is making this look way too easy at 23XI Racing, with 4 wins in 6 starts. After Reddick smoked the Darlington field and ran away from Brad Keselowski by 5.847 seconds, which is the largest winning margin since Bill Elliott claimed the 1994 Southern 500 by 6.39 seconds, the Ford driver said it's basically the field versus Reddick right now. Keselowski, when asked what he needed to beat the sport's new star, quote, "A lot. We're not that close to him. He's in another category for sure. He was really in a class of his own," unquote. And that's the source of much of the current frustration. And it won't be alleviated until NASCAR's rest figures out how to outrun the driver who is currently NASCAR's best. And that was the article, Frustration Expected in Chase of Reddick. Well, we're at 30 minutes past the hour, so we're going to leave the sports section and move on over to the viewpoint section to read some opinion pieces. So on the cover of the viewpoint section of the paper, at the top of the page, there is this it looks like earth movers, but they've got a scoop on the end of them, and it's like a digger for digging trenches. There's two of them. They look like they're opposing each other, and the title above the picture is Finding Balance. Underneath the picture, there are two columns, so we have two, looks like probably differing viewpoints. So the first viewpoint or opinion piece that I'm going to read is subtitled, I'm Okay with New Houses in My Historic Neighborhood. This is written by Jacob Armour, a guest columnist. Here's what Jacob wrote. Despite the current push by a few special interest groups to fight the state law allowing middle housing by advocating to pass HB 2375, which would exempt historic neighborhoods, this position is not representative of most historic homeowners like myself. The middle housing law is designed to address the state's housing shortage and affordability crisis by bringing more housing options to areas around the downtown jobs center. Many people struggle to find houses near downtown Phoenix that match their budget, as there are mainly large apartment complexes or larger expensive homes beyond the reach of many. Overall, Phoenix's median home price has more than doubled in a decade, and rents in many parts of the valley have seen large increases over the years. While law won't solve the issue, it is a necessary component of the broader solution, as increasing the housing supply is one of the best ways to address affordability. Even for those of us who already own our homes, it's easy to see how our neighborhood could benefit from some new homes and residents. On the walk to school, we pass a vacant lot that has been empty for years, across from a gas station and a payday loan place that used to be a local donut shop. We have to scurry across five busy lanes of McDowell Road without a crosswalk because there aren't enough residents who walk there for the city standards to kick in and add one. Allowing more middle housing and residents will help us improve these issues and more, including economic development, transportation, and education. Of course, I do understand the initial concerns some neighbors have about adding new homes. I love my family's walks around our historic neighborhood, the architecture, the landscaping, but most of all, the wonderful people we see. Historic neighborhoods are special and deserve the protection and tax incentives they currently enjoy. The idea of change can feel scary at first, but when I speak to people, I find that when you take a moment to explain the policy and get beyond the talking points, there is a lot we agree on. Many neighbors are not just unopposed to middle housing, but in fact, they strongly support it. For instance, I sometimes hear that allowing more homes will incentivize builders to purchase historic homes, demolish them, and then build multifamily units on the property. But this theory does not reflect the reality of the process. Most historic homes are expensive to buy and have a long, burdensome, and costly regulatory process for demolition. The economics of a developer paying a premium price and then jumping through regulatory hoops for a year only to then pay extra to build housing that complies with the historic preservation rules, it just doesn't make sense. Publicly available information on demolition requests for historic properties shows that there are no requests to demolish historic single-family homes and then build multifamily housing. That threat that some fear has not materialized. What we will realistically see in the next few years is a limited number of new, smaller housing options replacing vacant lots, lots with non-historic homes, or homes in disrepair. New homes will still have to comply with the existing historic preservation protections that are currently in place and administered through the city's Historic Preservation Office. These new homes will add to the vibrancy of the neighborhoods and bring numerous benefits to our city and state. So, while you may see support for HB 2375, please keep in mind that there is also strong support for more housing options. If you stop and look at the facts and potential benefits of the middle housing law, I expect you'll feel the same. That was an opinion piece written by Jacob Armour. Jacob has been a resident of the historic Encanto Palmcroft neighborhood for 6 years and is the deputy general counsel at a registered investment advisor. Our other opinion piece, kind of at odds with this, was written by Mary Durand, and hers is entitled, Historic Homeowners Want a Say on Neighborhood Design. Willow is a small section of homes, old homes, between Thomas and McDowell Roads and 1st and 7th Avenues. It's just a speck on the map of Phoenix, but one that I have called home since 1984. When I decided to move here, friends were concerned. I was a single woman in an area that was not considered safe at the time. At that time, Willow had very little in the way of restaurants, and the town seemed to close down early in the evening. Arizona State University had not built its downtown campus yet. There was no light rail, which Willow was the first district to support, and very few apartments. But the rent was affordable, and it was close to work, and the commute was easy. It did not take long for me to realize that this area was different. Residents knew each other, gathered together often, helped when help was needed, and banded together to create a sustainable community for the long term. Improving and preserving these old homes was our goal, as many residents had come from other states where historic areas were honored. I saved for 6 years to purchase a home here, because I did not want to leave this exceptional community. In 1990, I reached my goal, and I have lived in my 100-year-old home ever since. A great deal of work has gone into updating and maintaining this and every old home in my neighborhood. We have grown and prospered because we have invested our time and energy improving every component of this warm and welcoming place to live. Because of that, Willow residents took the time and a great deal of effort to develop a well-thought-out conservation plan that we presented to the City of Phoenix to sustain our historic and architecturally diverse community, and that city approved the plan in 1986. Since then, the Willow District has grown and improved for all the incredibly diverse residents. Our home tour is the most attended in the city. Once a month, residents gather at other homes for meet and greets. Children are everywhere. We watch out for one another and welcome all newcomers with open arms. Maintaining the texture of the area has been a success. In 2024, the Arizona Legislature passed HB 2721, which was touted as a move to increase affordable housing, an admirable and needed goal for the entire state. I don't know anyone who doesn't agree that we need more affordable housing. However, the issue for historic districts arose after the bill was enacted. Citizens depend on our representatives to inform us of the actions being considered and get our feedback and then vote. And that did not happen with this bill. We learned after passage that our conservation plan was no longer applicable to housing regulations. Housing built or converted in the oldest sections of Phoenix would no longer have to abide by the long-standing guidelines that had served the communities for so long. No one argued against additional housing. We just wanted it to abide by our long-standing guidelines. With the introduction of HB 2375 this legislative session, it will fix the error preventing historic district residents from having any say in how their neighborhood looks, feels, or grows. This bill granting an exemption passed the Arizona House and is now before the Senate. It was supported by all historic districts affected, as well as Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego and the City Council. The residents of historic districts appeared before the Phoenix City Council and the state legislature to voice our concerns and request an exemption for the design and construction of new housing. This became particularly necessary after the city showed residents what the new bills would look like. They are about as far from historic design as possible. Both the neighborhood's character and the residents' lifelong property investments were impacted. Now, the Willow District is not made up of cookie-cutter homes. The range of design is part of the charm. No two homes are alike. We have duplexes, triplexes, and apartments that were built or refitted in compliance with the earlier guidelines. This proposed bill will return the guidelines that have served the community well. Historic districts are not trying to keep people out. We welcome all who want to live here. We have an exceptional mix of people from every ethnic and religious background. We're mostly middle-class, hard-working folks who face the same obstacles that everyone faces when looking for housing. All we have asked for is the ability to maintain the unique mix of architectural and historic aspects in new and refitted residences, the same way that neighborhoods with HOAs are allowed. Yet we've been vilified and accused of being racist, isolationist, and unwelcoming, not in my backyard, rich enough to hire high-dollar lobbyists to keep working-class people from living here. And that could not be further from the truth. All I want is a say in how our neighborhood looks. And that was written by Mary Duran. She's worked in criminal justice for 56 years. She remains an outspoken social worker and a proud resident of the Willow neighborhood of Phoenix. Well, we have a couple minutes left in the viewpoint section of the paper. How about, let's see if we can find a couple letters to the editor. Well, the first letter goes like this. What State Senator Jake Hoffman, Republican from Queen Creek, is doing, trying to ban books, is a waste of time and, frankly, an attempt to stifle free speech. Republicans were hell-bent on calling out the left for its cancel culture, and here he is doling it out under the guise of protecting children. The books that he is talking about have been around and in libraries for years. I challenge him to cite one instance where something dangerous, nefarious, or illegal happened as a direct result from a child reading one of these so-called obscene materials. Why wasn't he speaking out against these materials years ago? I guess up till now, this wasn't a problem. But with the current political climate, any form of suppression is okay with Republicans. We have so many real problems, yet here he is wasting time on a non-existent one. What a waste. Signed, Thomas Smoody from Gilbert. Our next letter goes like this. Trump took to social media to cheer the death of Robert Mueller. This is disgusting and unacceptable. The rhetoric used by Trump got some people who used it about Charlie Kirk fired. Our media, our public, cannot continue to excuse Trump for these types of comments. Signed, Joseph Zanzucci from Phoenix. And our next letter goes like this. Tom Horn is taking a page right out of the Trump administration playbook. Attack the media for covering uncomfortable topics. Horn says that the claims of fraud in the Empowerment Scholarship Account voucher program are inappropriate and must stop. But Horn is responsible for overseeing a system that is ripe for fraud and abuse. He claims that only 2% of all purchases in the program were unacceptable. I find that laughable. But let's say that's true. Only 2%? Do we have so much money in Arizona that 2% can be considered a rounding error? The ESA program is a mistake, and Horn has made it worse. Public dollars should go to public schools. But the Republicans in our legislature, in their never-ending quest to privatize all of government, saw it differently. But Horn took it to a new level by letting parents make purchases without pre-authorization, only to be reviewed after the fact. Even Horn must know that it's much easier to say, you can't have it, than give it back. The entire program should be scrapped, or at least made needs-based. Unfortunately, Horn, whose title includes public instruction, is just a typical privatization Republican. Signed, Dan Peel of Scottsdale. Well, we've reached 45 minutes past the hour, so we have to leave the viewpoint section, move on over to entertainment, and begin by reading today's horoscopes. We begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Desire brings you back to yourself today. Are you ready to be honest about what lights you up? Sudden realizations hit hard. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, you can be a wild card today. Your deliberate withdrawal is supported. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, are you rethinking how you express yourself? Communications or conversations can feel abruptly charged or destabilizing. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, let your aspirations shake your comfort zones. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd, give your identity room to breathe. For you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, emotions can stir things up behind the scenes. Unconscious patterns are ready to be interrupted. For Libras, birth dates from September 23rd through October 23rd, a breakthrough in terms of where you belong may occur. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, taking the lead on a project can be difficult when people go rogue. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, sticking to a routine may feel impossible today. Your restless desires for fun and adventure may be sparked. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, your ability to lighten up when unexpected pleasures come knocking is tested. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, grab a partner. Get out of your comfort zone. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Are you feeling burnt out? Your productivity may be disrupted, so think twice about what you do. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I have fallen out with my best friend of 20 years. I'm not sure how to proceed. A few years ago, she started a new job and became too busy for chats or to catch up. However, whenever we do manage to catch or chat, she wades in with advice and suggestions about what I need to do to improve my situation. I'm recently separated from a marriage of 20 years. I'm trying to keep things even for my two teenage children. I became increasingly frustrated by how inappropriate her suggestions were, and eventually lost my temper. I told her to stop making suggestions as they weren't helpful, and that she was too removed from my life. That was 3 months ago, and since then, she has ceased all contact and did not reply to my apology for losing my temper. She said no one has ever hurt her the way I hurt her. She has now emailed me, asking to meet when she is less busy, saying that she's still very hurt, but she misses me. I miss her too, but at the same time, I don't miss the stupid suggestions. She's godmother to one of my children. Well, she has had no contact with her since this happened, even missed her birthday. How should I handle this? I'm very hurt at how she deserted me at a time when I needed people around me while going through a painful separation. Signed, Deserted in Dublin, Ireland. And Abby responds, Dear Deserted, emotions are raw and folks are rarely at their best when growing through a divorce. At the same time, your friend appears to be stressed because of her work schedule. Since your separation, you are looking for more emotional support and contact than she is now able to give you. She, too, was hurt when you, with no filter, rejected her attempts to be helpful. You did the right thing to apologize. Be glad there is a thaw on the horizon, because when, with time, things may improve if you can tactfully communicate what you need and do not need from her. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, we just moved back to Southern California and into a gated community. My neighbor's property is higher than mine, and she has a spiky, thorny hedge that's growing over into my property and staining the side of my house. I went over and introduced myself, wanting to discuss the issue. My neighbor's reply was, That's your hedge. The next thing I know, she has a person trim it and throw all of the clippings into my backyard for me to clean up. How do I deal with a neighbor like this? Signed, a Thorny Relationship. And Abby responds, Dear Thorny, contact the Homeowners Association. Describe what's been going on. Your neighbor may be violating the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, known as the CC&Rs, and there may be fines for this. It's important that you establish where your property line ends and hers begins. If the plant really is on your land, you may have the right to remove it entirely. And remember, with Abigail, you can contact Abigail Van Buren in two different ways. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter, mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And now, at 52 minutes past the hour, we're going to take a look at some comic strips. Well, in the comic strip, Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, there's just two frames. A really big frame. Mom looks exasperated. She's got her arms spread out. Looks like there's sweat coming off her head. She's grimacing. And all around her are these little messages. Mom, I couldn't find my keys, so I took yours. Mom, is the microwave insured? Turns out showerheads can't hold my body weight. Mom, eyebrows go back, right? Mom, if you're looking for the toaster, it's in the dishwasher. Oh, there's a bat in my bedroom. I need to bring a flan for Spanish class tomorrow. Can you bring my biology report and 11 earthworms? Can you bring me my biology report and 11 earthworms? And in that small little second frame, Mom's passed out on the couch, and Dad leans over the back and says, Death by text is not a thing. And Mom groans and says, It's your turn to be the mom. And that was Zitz. Then, in Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, there's a first frame, there's Sergeant Snorkel, and he's looking at a gigantic pizza. And he says, How am I going to get across this pizza? And in the second frame, I'll try stepping on the pepperonis. And he steps from one pepperoni to another. And then he falls off a pepperoni and into the tomato sauce and goes sploosh. And then he screams, Help! And he wakes up. And he's in the barracks, in his bed, his bunk. And there he is in his bunk. And oh, there's an open pizza box at the foot of the bunk. And Sergeant Snorkel goes, "I was drowning in mozzarella." And Beetle comes by and says, "No more pizza at bedtime for you." And that was Beetle Bailey. And then for Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, we have Dagwood at the office. "Wow," one worker says to another. They're standing in the hallway watching Dagwood. "Wow, Dagwood really is on the ball today." And the other one says, "Well, I loaded the break room refrigerator with energy drinks this morning." And in the second frame, "Well, now I know why they disappeared so quickly." There goes Dagwood racing across the room. And then Mr. Dithers is standing there, and he says, "Yep, he's been taking care of business all day. He's even an inspiration to the rest of the crew. If he can keep that pace up, he'll be my employee of the year." And as they walk away, all of a sudden, Dagwood crashes in his office, and he's fallen sound asleep at his desk, and he's snoring. And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip, Peanuts, featuring good old Charlie Brown, Linus says, is it, oh, he comes running down the street, and there's Lucy sitting on the front steps, and Linus comes up, he's coming, and Lucy says, "Who, the Easter Beagle?" And Linus says, no, not the Easter Beagle, and then she says, "Well, who is it the Great Pumpkin?" And then they turn, they start to run down to the street, and Linus says, no, not the Great Pumpkin. And Lucy says, "Well, then, who is it? Who's coming?" And Linus points and says, "The April Fool." And there's Snoopy, dressed up with a clown hat and a big red clown nose and some ears on and some weird-looking things on his paws and looks like big shoes on his feet. And in the background, there's Charlie Brown. And Charlie Brown says, "Why can't I have a normal dog like everyone else?" And that was Peanuts. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 29th, 2026. Have a great day.